Most of us enter Harriet Tubman's life when she was in her 30s, 40s, 50s, and oftentimes we don't sort of think about how she came to be Harriet.
I'm Celeste Headlee, and this is Following Harriet. You know, I think for people of my generation, people who grew up in the 1970s, we first met Harriet in a photo in the corner of a textbook. She looked old. Her skin was stretched tight on her face, her mouth was pinched, her head was wrapped in a dark kerchief. We read a couple paragraphs about how she freed herself from slavery and then became a conductor in the Underground Railroad. She saved the lives of many other people, guided them safely from slavery to freedom. That was it. That was the whole story we were told. But Harriet Tubman was so much more than a small woman with a lantern in the woods. She was a wife and mother, an entrepreneur, a soldier, spy, nurse, and an activist who fought for women's right to vote.
I can honestly say, after working on this project, she's really one of the most incredible and brave individuals I've ever sort of come across.
That's Erica Armstrong Dunbar. She's a history professor at Rutgers University, and she's got a new book coming out called She Came to Slay, The Life and Times of Harriet Tubman. Erica says in the beginning, Harriet wasn't even Harriet. She was Araminta, or Minty, as her family called her. Her parents were Harriet Green and Ben Ross, and they were both enslaved on the eastern shore of Maryland. They had at least 9 children, and Araminta was in the middle, born sometime around 1822.
One of the things about enslavement was that the sale of slaves, the forced movement and migration always left enslaved families vulnerable. And we see that happen for Harriet and Ben. At a certain point, they're separated, and Harriet is forced to move with her children, including Araminta, to another farm 10 miles away from her husband. They would continue to see one another, to remain connected, but they didn't live together. And it was really sort of at that moment that we begin to see just how fragile the lives of enslaved people were.
Araminta was rented out when she was still a child, before she even had a full set of adult teeth. She was pressed to learn how to weave patterns that would have been difficult for an adult. She was forced to empty the muskrat traps on one of the farms where she lived. She did domestic work.
Getting up very early, carrying large loads of water to and from the house, plucking chickens, making soap, work that never ended. And she was expected to do this no matter her health. She got the measles when she was a small child, emptying muskrat traps, and she was still expected to work. And on occasion, she would come back to her mother's, the farm on which her mother lived, and would be nursed back to health, and then she would be sent out once again to work.
When Araminta was around 5, she was hired out to a family who wanted her to help care for their infant. Catherine Clinton is a historian at the University of Texas, San Antonio, and author of the biography Harriet Tubman, The Road to Freedom.
And there were incidents where she recalled that the moment the baby began to cry, the mother, instead of reaching for her baby, might reach for a switch in order to whip Harriet for letting the baby cry, because it was her charge to keep the baby quiet. This shows the kind of abuses that the enslaved endured under slavery.
At a certain point when Araminta had been hired out, we would call her a tweener. She was somewhere between the ages of 12 and 15 or 16. And she went for what was supposed to be a quick errand to the general store, the local store. And it was clear that an enslaved man who lived on a nearby farm was in the act of, we're not certain if it was escape or if he was simply running away from an angry overseer, someone who was angered by the fact that this enslaved man had created some infraction of the rules and he was chasing him. And they run into this general store at the moment that Araminta's there. And this overseer says to Araminta, sort of mandates that she help subdue this man and to help tie up his hands, and she refuses. We sort of think about this moment where she, perhaps it's her first stance against slavery. And in that moment that she chooses not to act, the enslaved man, he escapes, he runs off. And the overseer is enraged and he picks up a metal weight and he hurls the weight in the direction of, it wasn't necessarily intended to hit Araminta. He was really attempting to hit this enslaved man who was attempting to escape. But Araminta, then Harriet, got in the way of that weight. And so when Araminta was struck with this 2-pound metal weight, she was, in essence, just felled immediately. Her skull was fractured. She was bleeding profusely. And of course, she received no medical care. And at this moment, this sort of terribly violent moment in which we see the abusiveness of enslavement and the horror of it, there's also something sort of special that happens to Araminta. She later on suggests that it was God entering her life. And from that moment on, she would have visions and she would fall into deep, basically sleeping spells where she could not be roused from that sleep. And when she came to, she often had visions or memories that gave her information or led her in certain directions, told her things that would happen in the future.
And all that time, in my dreams and visions, I seemed to see a line. And on the other side of that line were green fields and lovely flowers, and beautiful white ladies who stretched out their arms to me over the line, but I couldn't reach them no how. I always fell before I got to the line.
That's a quote we have from Harriet about her visions. Now, she never could read or write. She signed her name with an X. But a historian named Sarah H. Bradford interviewed Harriet in the 1860s and wrote multiple books about her. Catherine Clinton continues describing those sleeping spells.
Harriet herself called it losing time. So frequently, scholars might disagree or experts might debate. We don't really have medical records for her. We don't really know what she suffered from. So I tried whenever possible to use her own language, to use her own recollections, because I think that we have very few of her words, and we even have disputes over which words were her own or which words were put into her mouth. But at the same time, we know that she was indeed someone who overcame these great obstacles. So whatever her disability, it was something that she was able to not use to her advantage, but I think she clearly was able to be more careful and cautious. And we have to remember the main way in which we know about people on the Underground Railroad is because they were caught. And most of her infamous comrades were caught and jailed, and some were caught and jailed and died in jail, and she was someone who was never caught.
Just how was Araminta, who had not yet taken the name Harriet Tubman, able to elude everyone who tried to catch her? We'll have that after the break. Just a quick note here to say that if you'd like to learn more about visiting places that tell the story of Harriet Tubman, the Underground Railroad, and the 19th century African-American experience, especially in the state of Virginia, go to virginia.org/Harriet.
So Slavery and freedom always existed in Maryland, but they never eclipsed one another.
Jessica Millward is an associate professor of history and African American studies at the University of California, Irvine. She specializes in slavery, emancipation, Black women's history, and Maryland.
At some point in the 19th century, the harvesting of wheat became more profitable. So slave owners actually found themselves with human property, and they didn't necessarily need their laborers full time in terms of year round. Tobacco production requires people to work year round, where cultivating wheat does not. So there were jobs for free Blacks to be laundresses or blacksmiths.
When Jessica says jobs, she means paying jobs. This often surprises people, but there were a lot of free Black people in Maryland in the 1800s. In fact, by the time of the Civil War, nearly half of all Blacks and people of color were free in Maryland. That could happen several different ways. A child born to a white mother and a Black father was considered free because the mother status defined the child's. An enslaved person could petition the courts to be freed. Sometimes an enslaved person could negotiate payment for being rented out to other families. He could save up that money and, if his owner allowed it, buy his freedom. The slave owner could leave a written will saying something like, "At the time of my death, I want my slave to be free." That's how Araminta's father, Ben Ross, became free. He was manumitted, or freed by his owner, when he turned 45. Ben was a skilled woodsman, and even after he was freed, he continued to manage his former owner's timber business. Araminta, she had not yet changed her name to Harriet, joined him on the farm when she was a teenager. Again, historians Catherine Clinton and Erica Armstrong Dunbar.
Harriet was a very intrepid, independent person, and she was quite happy, for example, to be working on a canal because it meant she didn't have the close supervision of a white master or mistress, which she found unpleasant and abusive. So she was able to go out and work in the field and work doing heavy labor, and she was really admired by men and women for her physical strength, for her mental acuity.
And so there's a moment in Ben's life where he's actually granted his freedom. And while most of us would sort of think that this was a moment for him to rejoice, for him to celebrate, and I'm not saying that he didn't, I would argue, though, that it came at a moment when he would watch his daughter plowing fields and breaking flax and doing some of the most difficult, arduous labor. And so what does it mean to be free when your family is not? How free is free?
In 1844, Araminta, who was about 19 years old, met and married a free Black man named John Tubman. She took his last name. Family lore suggests that she was deeply in love with him. At some point, she started thinking about a life beyond the farm where she lived. In 1849, she's sick again, so not worth as much to her owner. He tries to sell her. She prays to God that her owner would change his mind.
"I prayed all night long for my master till the 1st of March, and all the time he was bringing people to look at me and trying to sell me. I changed my prayer. I began to pray, 'Oh Lord, if you ain't never going to change that man's heart, kill him, Lord, and take him out of the way.'"
Her owner died not long after. To settle the estate, his widow began working to sell all their slaves. Three of Araminta's sisters were sold south. This was likely the moment that spurred her to action.
"There was one of two things I had a right to, liberty or death. If I could not have one, I would have the other."
On September 17th, 1849, Harriet and her brothers Ben and Henry ran away from the farm. Historian Erica Armstrong Dunbar.
The plan was to escape toward Philadelphia, and at some point, her brothers decided that it was a bad idea. They got scared. They were concerned. They didn't know if they could actually make it. And they decided that they would rather face punishment and even the possibility of sale, maybe hoping that if they were sold away from their family, it would be to a nearby farm or a plantation. They decided that risk was a better option than taking their chances in the woods, being chased by bounty hunters and dogs. And they decided to return. And while their sister did not want to return, they forced her. They dragged her back. And it's really this sort of moment in her life that, you know, no man would ever sort of determine her direction again. So when they return and they're sort of awaiting their fate, Harriet Tubman makes the decision that she would not sit around and wait. And she alone took to the woods and escaped in the late fall of 1849.
She evaded capture and made it all the way to Philadelphia.
When I found I had crossed that line, I looked at my hands to see if I was the same person. There was such a glory over everything. The sun came like gold through the trees and over the fields, and I felt like I was in heaven.
Araminta had also made herself a new identity. As you might imagine, enslaved people who attempted escape would often change their names to better disguise themselves. Araminta did just that. Some historical accounts say that she assumed her mother's first name of Harriet and adopted her husband's last name of Tubman before she escaped. Some say it was after. Regardless, by 1849, she had reinvented herself as Harriet Tubman.
Later on, when her narrative was penned, she explained that she was arrived in Philadelphia, and while this was or should have been a joyous moment, she felt isolated and she worried about her family. And she really, at that moment, committed herself to rescuing her family and to pulling them out of the jaws of slavery. And over the next decade, she would do just that.
She started with her husband. John Tubman had refused to go with her when she escaped in 1849. In fact, he'd actively discouraged her from self-emancipating, saying that in addition to the risk she was taking with her own life, her actions could also have repercussions for him and her family. But Harriet worked hard in Philadelphia and saved up the money to go back down and get him. She even purchased a suit for him to wear on the trip back up. When she finally made it back to her hometown...
Yeah, that didn't go as she expected.
Harriet found that John had married another woman. Again, historian Jessica Millward.
You would think that, you know, once you have gone to all this effort and risked your life to not just escape slavery, but to come back and come back to your sweetheart and say, please, I want you with me in freedom. And she returns and he has another wife. He wasn't going to leave.
She was heartbroken. But she committed to bringing the rest of her family to freedom. And that's how Harriet Tubman became a conductor on the Underground Railroad. One common misperception about Harriet Tubman is that she liberated hundreds of slaves from all over the South while working on the Underground Railroad. In reality, it was between 60 and 70. All of them were from Eastern Maryland, and most of them were her own family members. Still, she showed incredible bravery as she went back and forth, bringing people to freedom, all the while a price on her own head.
Just think about the scariest run of your life. I personally don't like to run. Now add running barefoot without a lot of food through woods or through marshy areas. These are not ideal conditions. Babies were usually drugged in any way they could be drugged with alcohol or with a version of what we would consider opiates so that they would stay quiet during the journey. But people did it because that's how important freedom was to them. And Harriet Tubman risked her life over and over again because that's how important freedom was to her.
there are stories about the fact that, for example, she would often go south on a train. She would use the train to travel back into slavery, because who would be suspicious of a black woman moving from north to south? And she might actually have a newspaper, and she might read that newspaper, even though she was illiterate, because everyone who might be looking for the infamous Harriet Tubman would know that she was an enslaved woman. She was a woman of action, while there were many men of words during the antebellum period.
It's 1861 or 62. Harriet Tubman is living in Canada with her family and doing some small speaking engagements, talking about the violence of slavery, her own escape, and her work on the Underground Railroad. Historian Erica Armstrong Dunbar.
And in so doing, she is literally asked by the governor of Massachusetts, John Andrew, to join the Union and to take her tools and her talents, the ones that she had really sort of honed during her time on the underground, to head down to South Carolina and to serve as a scout and a spy for the Union Army. And so, you know, this is one of the moments that most people who think they know anything about Tubman, they're like, wait a minute, she fought for the Union?
She did, but not right away. She's assigned to Port Royal in the Hilton Head District of South Carolina. It's a camp filled with what are known as contraband, runaway slaves who found shelter with the Union.
So she heads down to South Carolina, and although she's asked to be a scout and a spy, she is quickly sort of shuttled into duties that are anything but that. She's sort of forced into what was really domestic work. She was cooking and cleaning for the troops. She was helping recently emancipated people who had come to the Union lines. She was helping them sort of figure out a way to eke out a living. She created wash houses where formerly enslaved women would basically take the laundry of Union soldiers. And in order to make a little bit of money, they would do the laundry. She created a couple of eating houses, eateries, because Union soldiers were never fed well, were always hungry. And so these formerly enslaved women are out foraging in the forests looking for wild birds and boars and anything that they could turn into a food for Union soldiers. And Harriet Tubman's doing the same thing. At first, she's actually being paid by the Union Army. And that does not sort of sit well with all of the other formerly enslaved people. Tubman's smart, right? She realizes, okay, the last thing I want to do is to anger these folks, because my job is to come down here and to be a scout and a spy. And this may be a sort of temporary situation for me, but I'm going to need these people. I'm going to need them for information. And so she refuses to accept any kind of compensation in the form of food or clothing from the Union Army. And instead, she starts baking pies and making root beer. And she's literally asking formerly enslaved people to go into the camps and sell these pies. And so she's an entrepreneur, right? So not only is she brought down to be a spy and a scout, but because that doesn't happen quickly, she turns the tables and she realizes that she's going to have to make a living, and she's also going to have to win the hearts and the souls of the people around her. And she does just that.
And it pays off a year or so later when Harriet finally gets the chance to do the kind of espionage work she'd gone down there for. Union commanders began planning raids around South Carolina's coastal rivers to remove torpedoes, floating mines resting just below the surface of the water. They also wanted to seize supplies from area plantations and even destroy the plantations. And in the raids, they tried to free as many enslaved people as possible, especially males, and recruit them to fight for the Union. One of those raids, planned by Union Colonel James Montgomery, was orchestrated along the Combahee River near Beaufort, South Carolina.
And it was really a brilliant idea to go up the Combahee River and to strike deep in the heart of the plantation country, where you had hundreds of slaves trapped behind enemy lines, anchored on plantations.
Historian and biographer Catherine Clinton.
And by using her intelligence network, she was able to find out both where the torpedoes were planted, and torpedoes were stationary underwater explosive devices in the period. So naturally, the Confederates had used black labor for that.
Who buried those mines? Their slaves. And so that information from those enslaved people found its way to Harriet. So that Harriet was able, on June 2nd, 1863, to lead really a sort of fleet of over 300 men, mostly black soldiers, up the Combahee River. And really, they just lit it up.
Her description of that all-night adventure is just phenomenal. My name is Elva Therese Belches, and I am a public historian, author, archival researcher, and filmmaker. She talked about women running towards the shore who had rice pots still on their heads with steam coming out of them. Little kids were hanging on for dear lives onto their moms, and people actually had live chickens tied to their legs. And one of the things that was somewhat funny is that she recalled one lady who had both a black and a white pig, and Mrs. Tubman and Montgomery named the black one Jefferson Davis and the white one Beauregard.
She moved from port to port, from place to place along the riverbank at designated exodus spots where the enslaved people could come and be rescued and be taken to freedom in Beaufort, South Carolina.
You know, as people were running to freedom, as some of those gunboats became filled, some of the people trying to run to freedom held on to the boats because they didn't want the boats to leave them, even though they were full. So that became problematic. So what Montgomery did is he prevailed upon Mrs. Tubman to sing. I think he told her to sing to your people because he knew her reputation preceded her as a Moses for her people. I think at first she didn't know exactly what to sing, but she began to sing and people, you know, released their holds on the boats, hoping and praying that, yes, other vessels would be coming and they were able to, you know, continue on with their mission.
And it was really amazing that in the middle of the night, 750 slaves were liberated in one operation with a very small force of black Union soldiers on these Union boats. And it was a brilliant operation, and certainly the local Union officers commended her, applauded her, and she was known really as a secret weapon for the Combahee River raid.
And so when you sit back and you sort of think about someone managing to emancipate close to 1,000 people, you know, that's breathtaking. And that was Harriet Tubman.
As we learn about Harriet, we not only peer into the incredible life of one of our country's most iconic heroes, we also get a better understanding of the broader experience for African Americans in the 19th century. On the next episode, we travel to museums throughout Virginia and to the presidential homes of Thomas Jefferson and James Madison to hear how the stories of that African-American experience are being told today.
Mulberry Row is the plantation main street of Monticello. It's where all of the industrial labor took place. Jefferson in his lifetime enslaved over 600 people.
We also knew that we needed to own the fact that our guy, James Madison, political genius, father of the Constitution, you know, author of the Bill of Rights, this guy codified the institution of slavery.
I'm Celeste Headlee, and we're following Harriet. If you'd like to learn more about visiting places that tell the story of Harriet Tubman, the Underground Railroad, and the 19th century African-American experience, especially in the state of Virginia, go to virginia.org/Harriet. In this episode, we heard from several historians. Erica Armstrong Dunbar from Rutgers University, Catherine Clinton from the University of Texas San Antonio, Jessica Millward of the University of California Irvine, and Elva Therese Belches. Harriet Tubman was portrayed by Krista Walrock. We had production assistance from Kenny Burns, Maura Curry, Shana Deloria, and Miranda Fulmore. Following Harriet is a production by Ingredient Creative, with Tanya Ott as the writer and director and Tanner Latham as executive producer.
Following Harriet is sponsored by the Virginia Tourism Corporation and the Virginia Film Office.
It's kind of hard not to say, goodness gracious, this woman was real. You know, she was bad, just a badass. And
we're back up.
Kenny says we're back up. In some parts, some ways, I decided not to call her badass out of sort of reverence, just to Tubman. And sort of thinking about what my grandmother would say if she read a book that I wrote in which I called Harriet Tubman a badass. She'd say, Erica, what are you talking about? Watch your mouth. You know, that's like, honestly, that's the first thing that popped into, that's my, like, my sensibilities as a sort of middle-aged black woman who grew up, you know, with a black grandmother going to church, that you simply don't say those things, especially about your elders. And even though that's, you know, the phrase or the term badass, we use that now as a symbol or a sign of respect. I don't know. I decided to listen to Elsie Armstrong in my head and to call her a boss lady more frequently.